Everybody ready? Come on, let's go.
The Rick Flair Show! Let's go! The Rick Flair Show! Let's go!
Yo, what's up? Welcome to the Rick Thorne Show. I'm Rick Thorne. On this episode, I have a longtime friend, BMXer, stuntman, like all around, like the most interesting guy in the world, Mr. Mike Escamilla, aka Rooftop. Rooftop, what are you doing?
Hey, man, how are you?
I'm good, dude. I'm good. Look, I ain't gonna lie and say this is the first time I interviewed you. This is like probably the 18th time, but we gotta act like this is our first time meeting each other. Like, dude, what's up? You're so interesting. No way.
You've interviewed me probably multiple times over the last 25 years.
Easily, dude. I think the first time that we met, it was for 20 Inch Magazine, man. I swear it, at that Moreno Valley contest. And then right after that.
You think that's when we first met? I thought it was in Oklahoma City a few months before that.
No, it's the first time I interviewed you.
Oh, interviewed you, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't
We met a few years before that in 93?
Yeah, you were like a fan in the crowd, and you wanted me to sign your shirt or something. Wasn't that what it was about?
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. I was like, if I was a fan in the crowd, I was like, look at these dudes out here. Dude, they're 100 years old. I could do this.
I know. Now I'm like 101. I'm still cranking it out, bro. That's funny, dude. We've always had fun, dude. You know, like, but yeah, that was the first time. Yeah, man. Wow, time does fly, dude. What a trip. But anyhow.
It's crazy.
It is, dude.
I was thinking about it the other day because I was going through some old boxes here, and I come across some cassette tapes, and I was hoping this one, when I'd seen some cassette tapes, I was hoping one of them was it, but we'd met in 93, but we really started becoming friends, like actual friends in 94, because we met at the end of 93, and I remember you'd made me a mixtape and sent it to me, and it was like the tape that I had, like, it was on repeat in my car, and in my head it was like, that music was like the gateway to like what was cool.
Oh, that's rad, dude. Yeah, I remember those mixtapes. Those were fun.
If I remember right, you actually had a rap on there too.
Yeah, that was my early Good Guys in Black stuff I was putting out there, you know, just to send it a vibe. Yeah, dude, I used to make those tapes, bro? I used to do it from tape deck to tape deck.
Yeah, I know. It was so easy back then to do everything.
Dude, that took forever.
Extremely hard too.
Yeah, that took forever.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Dig that tape up, dude. I'd love to hear that rap. I put it on a new mix. Yeah, what up?
Oh my god! If I could find that, it would be the best thing ever.
Fuck, dude. Look,
I would release it. I would release it as a number one single.
Yeah, it'd go platinum. But anyhow, so back to you, brah. You know, as long as we've been friends. And known each other for such a long time. You know what's weird is I always ask this question to people that I've known for a long time, like you. How did you start? What got you into bike riding?
Well, I lived in a neighborhood in Southern California that just happened to have a lot of kids in it. I was very lucky. We had like four kids that lived next door, three kids that lived across the street, two up the street. And then at the bottom of the street, like the block at the bottom, there was one, two, three, four. There was another four guys, and all four of those guys rode bikes. And then they were part of another crew that kind of lived in the surrounding neighborhoods that had a bunch of friends, and they were all a little bit older than me. So they were all a year to 2 years older than me. And back then, if you're in the eighth grade and you're hanging out with a sixth grader, that's a big difference, you know? So it was like a big deal that I would like get to hang out with these kids, and they all rode jumps, and I rode around the neighborhood with them, and then we'd do these, you know, we'd head to the jumps on the weekend, or we'd ride over the hill to the mall on the weekend, and I just, when they all started getting in trouble or getting licenses, they all sort of stopped riding, and I just kept riding, and it was clear to me, even though they were clearly giving me a hard time, but I was one of them, you know, in the beginning, you could tell that I had a drive that was different for them. I think, you know, they were all riding bikes, but I always felt like I was doing something a little bit different, because I was doing probably the same tricks as them, but I was a lot younger. And then, you know, it slowly sort of passed what they were doing, and then I just kept riding and never stopped.
That's awesome. Yeah, I never, it sounds like the classic story where a lot of us got involved with riding back in the day. It wasn't like so much, you know, the sponsors or the, you know, just the lifestyle. It was just that feeling that you were going for. You always brought a different style though, dude. Like, didn't you ride with a lot of skaters though growing up? Because once you started busting out, you just brought a whole new element to riding that people weren't doing at the time.
Well, after all the bike riders first stopped riding, most of my friends in high school were other professional skateboarders. Paul Luna, Jeremy Ray, Jonas Ray, Pat Shaniga, Jason Dill in the early days. So those were guys that I would go out and ride the spots that they rode. So a lot of times the skate spots were smaller, and so I'd ride some of their stuff, or I looked at what they were doing, and I felt like I tried to adapt some of the stuff they were doing to my bike. Because that's just what we were riding, and it didn't seem weird to me because I was just trying to enjoy whatever spot we were going to. And I think in that, though, I feel like I definitely had an earlier skate sort of feel or influence to me than probably I did bike riding, because back then there wasn't the internet, and the only magazines you got were once a month or if you saw them on the stands, and there was no videos. I mean, the first video I ever saw was well into high school, or probably, you know, I was probably 9th or 10th grade, and my buddy Brian Castillo had a video, and he let me borrow it. I blew away. I'd never seen anything like it. So I had just seen skate videos, and that was sort of the life that I sort of was a part of, except I was on a bike. So although it didn't feel weird to me, I think definitely when I came in, I definitely had a different outlook on what I wanted to do and what I was doing, maybe.
Well, yeah, you did 100%, because even at the contest, you know, you would bring a different run that was like, whoa, like you just opened up new doors that were different than what was conditioned to the sport. You know, did you ever feel like you were doing that, or you were just riding, just doing your thing?
I think I was just riding. I think when you're just an arrogant little kid too, you're like, these dudes are nerds, kind of. Like, I remember when I would, because bike riding, you kind of got to wear knee pads on those big ramps and stuff. And skaters didn't wear pads when they street skate. And so I never wore them on the street, but for contests, I wore them. But I always thought they looked really stupid. And back then, bike riders always wear shorts and knee pads and their socks pulled up and shin guards.
Wait! I'm still doing that, dude.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry.
Come on, dude.
I started putting my knee pads under my jeans, and I mean, I remember like really big dudes would call me like rollerblader and things like that, and I'm like, I would look at them, I'm like, look in the mirror, dude, you look like a clown. And so I remember thinking that I felt like I was. I didn't really feel like I was doing something as much as I felt like I was just, I, you know, like a rebel or something, which clearly I'm like the least. I mean, when you think about it, you're just a kid. Where, like, the way you dress to other bike riders, there's nothing dangerous or rebelly about that. That was just how I saw the world around me at home. So that's what I was doing when I wasn't at home.
I get it. I mean, is that the reason why you rode the Rebel Yell at one of your contest runs? In the midnight hour! Scrap mold.
Yeah, wait, what?
More. Yeah, well, we the sport went through a lot of changes and stuff. Dude, if you were been a little earlier into the sport, we were competing like with our leathers and jerseys on. It looked like, you know, we were racing. So it's gone through different phases. But you brought so much, dude. You flipped off a freaking tree, bro. Were you the first to flip fakie off a tree?
No, I don't think so.
I think
Gons may have done it first. Or, you know, I don't know if he pulled it. I don't remember exactly, but I think Gons may have done it first. It was right in the same time frame. It's really hard on the early stuff because things happen and you don't see stuff. So you hear that someone did it, or you hear someone thinking about it, and you're like, oh, maybe I could do that, or maybe it's hard to remember. I'll be honest with you. I want to say Gons may have done it first, the biker Gons.
Yeah, but did he roll out of it, like put a foot down? That shit don't count. Put a foot down.
I have no idea. I don't remember. I don't remember.
Okay, let's talk about this one. Okay, so just anyone listening, so Rooftop hit a tree and you flipped off of it and came down backwards. It's called Flip Fakie. It was sick. It's in the Arnett video, My Way, old school. Let's talk about flipping this helicopter, dude. Like, how did that come about? It's just to all my listeners out there, back in the early 2000s, Mike flipped a freaking helicopter with the propellers moving, and that is, this is before Mega was even like a thing, right?
Yeah, actually, Danny Way had told me that Mega Ramp came about because of Matt's ramp and because of that, because of this helicopter flip. I got the opportunity for the MTV show, Send It Back to Video, and they asked if I wanted to do anything, and I said, hey, and I don't know if I even came up with that. I can't remember. This guy Carl, who worked for me, may have come with it. I don't remember. I had so many ideas back then, it's hard to remember, like, where things came from. But, we decided we were going to backflip over a helicopter with the blade spinning, and that took a bit of work. We'd never really built those big ramps before. We didn't know how to build them. We rented out Fullerton College. We tried to do it in my high school, but Fullerton College, and so we built like a Evel Knievel rolling down the stadium, and then a big jump and a landing. But the way we built the jump was completely wrong, so hitting it was like hitting a brick wall. We built it too steep. And so during practice, which is pretty, it's a pretty good story, actually, during practice, I started it by the ramp at like 8 feet, right? So like I only made it 8 feet, and we were moving the landing back as I got comfortable with it to know how fast I had to go, because clearly what I was told was if I fall into the helicopter, if I flip and throw the bike upside down and that the bike goes into the helicopter blades, the helicopter would flip over, start destroying everything and just go out of control until it disintegrated. And that's why no one could be near me. Everyone had to be 50 yards away or more. So
dang,
I,
dude, that's wild, dude, to think
yeah,
that.
Yeah. So I was just like by myself in the middle of this stadium. So what I was doing was, since you're rolling downhill, it's hard to calculate how fast you're going. So I would draw lines on the roll in, start there, roll in without pedaling, jump, and then I jump it, and then go back up. I take one full pedal and flip it, and then we'd move it back a couple feet. We'd move it a little bit, and I'd go up 8 feet. And we did that until we got the timing right. And I had it dialed. I'm like, all right, that's perfect. I know exactly how far I got to roll to do one pedal, and I'm going to flip this thing. But when the helicopter got in there, and you heard the blades,
hey, that was a good wait. That was a good helicopter sound.
Well, you know, I have a lot of experience with helicopters. What happened was I was either pedaling more or I was pumping the transition at the bottom hard, and I was over rotating and overshooting the thing. I mean, I only wanted to do this once, and now I had overshot it and over-rotated four times. And on top of that, the day before, I overshot it and jumped off, and I had a super badly bruised heel. It was just purple. So this, I was dying. So I did something now that I think about it, super dangerous, and I'm surprised I'm not dead. I went to the line that I had made for the right distance, and I went down to the neck fight. I was 8 feet down and rolled in. And I thought, there was a little bit of a deck on the landing, a one-foot deck. And I thought to myself, I'm going to case that deck with my back wheel to stop my rotation, which means I'm only clearing this thing by 3 or 4 inches. And so I did that. I went down one, and to be honest with you, if I think about the math in my head now, I should have cased Sprocket on the inside, fallen back in the helicopter and died. But I cased it, I clipped it perfectly, and I came around and it was done. And then I think years later, it got voted like number 6 or 8 of the top 10 gnarliest things ever to happen on MTV, like on top of with all the music acts and everything.
I think it should be like number 1, dude. That is sick, dude. Okay, did you?
I mean, for sure.
Yeah, man. I mean, let me ask you this. Was like the stadium, was you were at a high school, right? So was like it empty? It was just like you and the crew?
We're at college.
Or you're at college. So it was just like you and the crew, like no crowd.
No crowd. There was a little bit of a crowd like that was for the, that was like there with the show, but there was no crowd in the sense that it was, there was no audience.
Right. So you
it
woke
was
up.
Just the people working on the show.
So you woke up in the morning and you were like, all right, dude, I'm going to go flip a helicopter. I got to get self-motivated to do this. Because, you know, sometimes the crowd gets you pumped. You're like,
yeah.
All right, I'm going to do this. Your music's blasting. Like, yeah, man, let's do it. And, like, how was that, though, dude? That had to be kind of like.
Well, I was young and I thought I could do anything. So it probably wasn't that big of a deal. Because, like, I remember, too, I think we got 10 grand for it. And back then, that was a lot of money. And not that it's not a lot now, but it was, like, it was a ridiculous amount then. And so I just was like, sweet, I'm going to make some money today. But you know what's even, that happened in, I want to say, 2000, right? So that one wasn't so bad. But fast forward, like, 5 years later, and Mega Ramp's been invented, and they're doing it in an event at the X Games. and they don't let bikes on it, right? Bikes aren't allowed. And at that point, you're like, that's ridiculous. So
wait, hold up, though. Didn't you do a demo, though? Didn't they ask you to, like...
Hold on, I'm getting there.
Oh, okay.
So, they didn't let bikes in, and then I would always be like, hey, let us ride it. And I was always, like, testing X Games to do it. And then they called me a month before X Games and go, hey, how would you like to jump Mega and see if you can break the backflip world record? Which I think was 54 feet at the time by Alan Cook. And I was like, sure. Well, I'd never jumped a jump that big before or anything like it. There was no, they didn't exist anywhere. So I flew out to Travis Pastrana's house on the East Coast, and it was the only option I had, which he had his motocross foam pit at a moto lip, and that was the closest thing to it. So I would crank down the driveway, and I'd set the gap at however far it was, 50 feet, and I would flip into the foam, and then flip into the foam, and then I learned 360 in the foam, which is way harder than a backflip, and the way I had to do was I was doing one-handed table ones to dip it, to sort of, that was in my head the way I could slow the rotation, but I'd never done it before. So I show up the morning of X Games, and they tell me, hey, you got to be here at 9 a.m., or whatever it was, 8 a.m., 9 a.m., there's no crowd, so no one got to watch other than skaters in practice, and I was going to be the first bike rider to really jump Mega and set a world record with no crowd, nothing, just sort of silence and like five of the dudes skating it, just in their regular practice. That was super unmotivating.
I bet, because you're because you're there at the X Games, and you've been competing for years, so you know the environment that you're in, you know? That sucks.
And so I'd never even jumped it before, so I was scared. So I jumped the first time, crashed a couple times, and I started flipping it, had some disasters, ended up breaking the world record, setting it like 60 feet, maybe, or 16 and a half feet. And at that time, I mean, the way I see these records now is like, those records are based on how big the ramp is and what it's built for. You build a bigger ramp, you can go bigger, but those ramps cost, $500,000 to build or whatever they build, whatever they cost. So, for me to even, the sweet spot on those jumps was 50 feet, so to be 54, you have to overshoot it, and to do farther than that, you have to way overshoot it. When you overshoot it, you're starting to drop a long ways down that landing. So I had to, like, really slow a flip down. Anyways, I got it, did it, and then I was like, they thought it was done, and I was like, no, I knew I could work on this at 360, so I went it back up and then set the longest 360 world record. And it was really weird because I just came down, I pulled, and they did a little ceremony for me. I'm like, there's like four people there, a couple people, and that was it. I did that. It actually made play of the day. It made play of the day on SportsCenter, and it made play of the week on SportsCenter, which is pretty cool, like against all the other sports. But the funny thing was, is now at that time, I was the only person who'd ever done anything on Mega Ramp on bikes. The next year, they had a BMX event, invited five guys, and I wasn't invited.
It's like, what the hell? Yeah, that's crazy, man.
They invited dudes who didn't even want to enter. Like, and at the end of the day, they only had, like, I think Jamie Beswick might have pulled out. And me, being a dumb punk kid, made the biggest mistake ever. They asked me the day, once Jamie Beswick pulled out, and the day of the contest the following year, they're like, hey, you can ride it. And I was so pissed. I was like, I'm not riding your dumb contest. Which would have been dope, because I probably would have got first or second, probably.
Well, they were showing you respect. They were showing you respect, bro. You're not getting it, because, like, the first time around, dudes were like, what's going on here? Like, I don't know. They said some guy's doing a backflip world record. Oh, cool. Let's go get a corn dog. No one saw it. Come on. And then you're the first to jump, and they're not going to let you in. This is some BS politics, Roof. We got to get to the bottom of this.
It was just politics about, like, who were their guys. That's how it sort of worked. And I got that. But when you feel like you're the only dude doing it, and that happens, you're just like, in my head, it didn't make sense. But I don't. Now, looking back, I don't give a shit. Who cares?
Yeah, but it's still cool to say that you were the first to you know what I mean? But how many feet?
Yeah.
But how many feet was the helicopter? Was that under 50?
The helicopter was 30, I want to say it was 34 or 36 feet, which doesn't seem very far, but back then that was one of the biggest jumps you could jump. And the only reason it was really sketchy is nowadays those megaliths are they're like 10 feet tall, 9 to 10 feet tall, right? And they're really mellow, which makes it easy to go far. We never built anything, so the lip I built was only 6 feet tall, and it was pretty steep. So when you hit it, if you hit it going straight without the backflip, it bucked you, wanted to buck you over the bars. So So it was almost safer to back lip it because you're leaning through that kink. You know, there's just that fat hitting that transition so fast. So it was actually a really, really, I wouldn't want to jump that setup now ever again.
I don't blame you. I didn't want to jump it the first time. I mean, that's bananas,
yeah,
dude. Yeah, man. But you know what? You did it, dude, and you made history. And like, so, and you've done a lot of things that, like, you've been. You know, we talked about this before. You're one of the few dudes I know that's never worked, quote unquote, a regular job, even though what you do is your regular job. That's pretty cool. I mean, you never look. You never went into clean tables or wait on tables.
No, I did have a job. I did before
what?
You knew me.
What?
So before you knew me, well, you might actually, no, you would have known me. Actually, you would have known me. Right after high school.
Did you cut grass or
something? I wasn't making any money. And no, I was a welder. I welded some of the first X Games ramps.
Oh.
So I was a welder, and I worked for the company. I welded some of the first X Games ramps. But I worked I was working 6 hours a day, 12 hours, I mean, six days a week, 12 hours a day. And then I wasn't riding my bike at all, and I was blowing black shit out of my nose every day. And I was making great money. I remember, I think it would have been 1995. And I mean, I was a pro bike rider, but I just wasn't making any money. And I was making $17 an hour out of high school, and that seemed like a lot back then.
Yeah, dude.
I mean, it's probably, you know, people be psyched like that now. And so it was like a job I couldn't take, but I only did it for a few months, and I was over it. And the only other jobs I really had that I consider like real jobs, I was team manager for a little bit of Etnies for a few years. But even that, like, even though it was a real job, it wasn't like I had to show up every day. So. That was the only job I ever had that was like show up every day, other than when I was working stunts, which I consider a real job, but I know other people might not, you know?
So you welded the X Games ramps in 95?
Yes.
Did you do the vert ramp?
I would have done the flat bottoms I did the flat bottoms for vert ramp today.
That explains it. That explains why I got seventh place. That explains it, because I specifically remember the flat bottom not being sturdy, bro. Bro, come on, bro.
The only reason you guys haven't was because maybe I welded the flat bottom long enough for you to pedal fast enough to go higher.
Hey, the only reason I got seventh is there was only seven people in the class.
Yeah, you're lucky there was an eighth. You're lucky I didn't ride vert. You got eighth place.
Hey, dude, I was scraping for money back then in 95, dude, busting tables, and they gave us this remote control car. And so I was like, and so my ghetto ass always is like, You buy something at a garage sale, maybe you could take it back to the store. I returned that shit, got $80. I was like, woohoo! I didn't need a remote control car, dude, but $80 I needed, bro, because I was struggling. People don't get that about what we do. I mean, look, it's been through all this stuff we're talking about, and the glitz and the glam and all this stuff and the traveling. It is a grind. People probably think you make a lot more than you actually do.
I mean, it's like, you know, you go through phases. Some years you're making good, some years you're not, but it's all the difference between the thing that I think we have to put up with, or not put up with, but accept, and may not seem like a big deal, but it is mentally, is that really people are just paying us to put a sticker on our helmet, especially back then, on our bike, and that's really not needed. So I felt like every day, no matter we had a contract or not with a sponsor, I could lose my job. Like,
right.
I honestly feel like every day and every year when contracts are up, I have to assume that I do not have a job or make any money. So it was scary to think that, like, you worked all year, you started, you're doing good, you're buying the stuff, you have a home and all this, or a house and all this stuff, and all of a sudden, I know that I feel like every day we wake up and you're like, well, today could be the day. I mean, in fact, I have sponsors still now in the last 2 years that every time they call me, I see the caller ID, I'm like, well, getting fired.
You gotta send it.
Like, I ask him every time I answer the phone. I'm like, "You firing me?" He's like, "Stop saying that." But it's the truth, you know. You gotta accept it. I've been doing it long enough to know that that's just how it works.
Do you think that always pushed you to keep going, knowing that you could like lose it?
No, I don't think any. I really don't think anything I was doing was ever motivated by money or like the fact that I could lose it. Because even though it was scary, I think that like it wasn't until later in life you're like, "Oh God, what am I gonna do?" But, like, when you're younger, you're just like, well, I could lose it every day, and you're stressed about it, but you also didn't have the foresight to think, like, I'm going to do something else, because I was still in love with bike riding. It just didn't seem like, you know, I don't think I was, in my head, I wasn't going to cross that bridge until it happened, even though I was stressed out about it. And I think over the years of me doing other stuff, because I was always interested in other things, and the sponsors I had, I wrote for Etnies and Hurley and Nixon, And these companies that were all companies that I sort of got into because of my skater friends sort of introduced me to some of these guys. So they had teams that were skate, snow, and surf, and I got invited on a lot of the other trips. You know, I get invited on snow trips, heli trips in Alaska, or surf trips in Fiji. And I got to see all these things and be a part of them. And I think that just early on, that opened me up to seeing how much more stuff there was. And at that time, people in bike ride did not like. I got a lot of grief. People did not like that I did other stuff. They thought that, you know, you're a pro biker, you spend every day riding your bike. And in my head, to me, doing all those things were making me a better bike rider. Because like when I started snowboarding in the late 90s, that changed the way I look at bikes. All of a sudden, I was like, oh, I could 540 a 50-foot or 60-foot snowboard jump. Why am I not 540 things in my bike? Why can I land backwards over big things? And it made me think, like, oh, I could do anything backwards. I can land and turn around quick and on banks. And it was evolving my riding.
That's rad. But you're also a guy that's pretty talented at a lot of different things. I mean, when you snowboard, you probably pin it. You go for stuff, right? You're just not going down, like, back and forth. You're, like, going for jumps, right?
I mean, I used to. Back in the late 90s, I actually lived in the mountains. I was, like, in the winters, I would live in the mountains and snowboard 5 days a week and then ride my bike on the weekends. Because back then, there wasn't a ton of contest. So, and that's what you were, your whole life was based on contest and video parts. So there you had time in between. But yeah, I mean, there was a time when I was like, you know, I was like a little park rat and I was 720 in jumps and flipping stuff and doing rodeos and rails and also stuff and going heliboards in the winter. So there was a time when, yeah, I was into it. I was never super good, but I think that if I would have gotten into snowboarding in, like, during high school, I could have easily seen that as something that I could have progressed at to maybe make that my job if I had the same drive towards it as I did bike.
That's awesome. What do you think about touring, dude? Do you miss touring? Remember the Tony Hawk tours, the Gigantic Skate Park tour, and all the stuff, the Hoffman tours, and all the stuff we've done? Do you ever miss just being touring a bike rider?
Yeah, I mean, I miss touring. It's not so much the touring. Like, I don't really miss, like, living in a bus for 6 weeks. I mean, it's fun, but I think now with driving nuts. But what I miss the most is just the other guys that you were doing it with, right? Like, they're all there for the same reason, to be riding bikes, having fun, and sort of live this life of a, you know, of a vagabond, I guess. I don't really know. I'm a nomad in this tour bus. And I think you were just young and having fun and taking advantage of the opportunity put in front of you. But I think that's what I miss most. I mean, even now when we go on trips, which are far and few between, it's not the riding that's fun on the trips. It's the sitting on the deck and in the car and searching around and then the shooting the shit and laughing with your buddies that I think I miss the most.
Yeah, I miss it. I miss it too, dude. I miss just the camaraderie, which is cool. And, like, did you ever think that from riding that you would become a stuntman? Do you think that helped you become a stuntman?
Hell yeah. I've wanted to be a stuntman since I was, like, in the seventh grade. Even my first interview in Ride Magazine, when I would have been, like, 15 or something, even says, like, I talked to him, I'm going to be a stuntman one day. I always wanted to be a stuntman. But, I mean, for the first jobs I ever got were all bike jobs. And then for the first 10 years, it was all bike jobs. Until I did this movie, Stick It, for Disney, the gymnastics movie. And there was a BMX sequence in the beginning. And I got there, and I sort of redesigned the BMX sequence to make it a little better. And it was actually a really amazing stunt sequence because we actually did everything, and the stuff we did was actually really hard and sketchy. And we took three bike riders to do it. And I actually got nominated. Me and Eddie Fiola got nominated for this part of the sequence. I got nominated for a Taurus Stunt Award, which is like the Oscars of stunts. So it was a really great experience. And then after that movie, there was a stunt guy working on it, a stunt coordinator, Jimmy Romano, who then he started hiring me to do things other than bike riding. So he really gave me my first sort of start on stuff that was outside what I was usually getting work for.
What are some of the movies that you've done stunts in?
In the last 2 years, I've been in four Marvel movies, Captain Marvel, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Captain America, Winter Soldier, Ant-Man, let's see what else. American Sniper, Horrible Bosses 2, what else?
Mall Cop. We were at Mall Cop.
Together, yeah.
We were. Mall Cop was cool.
I forgot about that. Yeah, we actually got hired for stunts, and then we went for some roles, and we actually played the bad guys.
You know, I didn't even know I was doing stunts when I went there. I had no idea, actually. I was not informed. I wasn't at all.
You thought you got hired for the acting?
Yeah,
I thought
I was like going to be like co-starring or something. I was like, well, am I just a stupid bike shit? The hell am I doing here?
Are you serious?
No, I'm not stupid bike shit. I didn't mean that. But I meant like, yeah, when we went to that, I had no idea. Like the day before I left, they said, bring your bike. Well, you know, the best part about it is Mall Cop is those residual checks, dude.
Of all the movies I've done, Mall Cop has been like the one that, me and you did Triple X together too earlier, eight years earlier. So I'm sure where we had like cameos playing ourselves. But Mall Cop, of all the movies, residual wise, has been the most steady. I can't believe that I still get checks from Mall Cop that are like legitimately checks that I'm like, wow. I mean, you know, they're not huge, but I'll get a check that's like $1,800 or something, and I'm like, that was over a decade ago. I can't believe I still get these checks.
So all you get is $1,800. What kind of deal you signed, though?
Yeah. What's that?
What kind of deal did you sign? You're only getting $1,800. My last check was like, I think it was like 19 grand or something like that. Like,
yeah, right.
And I'm like, what up, bro? It's cool. I'll just spend it on some stuff, you know?
Yeah, I think maybe you got a little extra from being on the casting couch.
That's how I roll, dude. See? That's what happens when you got no teeth. So check this out, dude. Stuntman, like, you're freaking killing it. Like, is there ever a stunt that you go, I don't know, bro. Like, tell me what kind of stunts you do. Like, you just, like, trip over a wire? Anyone could do that, dude. Car stunts, easy.
Most of the time...
Come on, tell me some tough stunts.
Obviously, my specialty would be anything on a bike, right? So I've done a bunch of bike stuff, or, you know, rated stuff, tipped over stuff.
And imagine that.
Jump and hit things. Yeah, I know. Most of it is called NDs, just nondescript stunts. It's just a lot of falling down, getting shot, and going downstairs, backwards, and crushed by things, and on wires, getting slammed into stuff. But there has been some, I had a few driving things, not a ton, but I had a driving thing on Ant-Man that was just had a drive down that hit my mark and not go too far because an explosion goes off, and I'm basically in an explosion by a tank. We did some stunt driving in Denethes. I was in Denethes as well. But that stunt driving was the hardest stunt driving I've ever done. It required about 30 stuntmen to make traffic for 2 days. So we just made traffic. And I mean, it's crazy. We got paid. We worked on it for a week of just like us going around the block, making traffic. So this gunfight and car chase to go on in between the traffic.
That's not a stunt, Mike. That's not a stunt.
Oh, yeah? Pays the same.
That's every day. Dude, that's every day LA, dude. You got paid like LA traffic. Sick, dude. I'm hyped for you.
It's pretty funny.
She's like, dude.
You'd be surprised how hard it is to, like, do that after doing it for a week in, like, 105-degree weather, and you've got to sit in a car for 12 or 13 hours a day. It's hard enough to just fall asleep.
Yeah, that's true. And
the car you're in is, like, a beat-up old car that has no air conditioning, and you're just by yourself all day, like, you're yelling at other cars, you know, 10, 15 feet away, just talking to people. But it's, you know, they're long days. They're not hard days, but they're, you know, they're days where you're just like, that's a long day in the car. But, you know, I'm getting on fire, I go through windows.
What's it like being set on fire, dude?
It's exactly what you think. You have a suit on, so you're doing your best to, what happens is a fire doesn't burn you. Usually it's you start to sweat, the sweat boils, and it'll burn you underneath, or you'll get licked by a flame. I've been licked on the nose and back of the ears and stuff, and get a little burnt, but it's exhausting. Every time I've had to do fire stuff, I always have to do a lot in a day. I think a little time before last that I did fire stuff, I did, I think, 13 or 14 burns in a day, and it was the chemical that your suit is soaked in, that your like fire retardant suit is soaked in, basically soaked into my skin. And at some point, I just like my whole equilibrium went off, and I basically was not high, but the stuff was affecting me. I was done. I couldn't walk or anything. I had to get out of the suit and let that stuff out of my system.
I hear you, dude. It seems like it would be gnarly. Hey, Strangers in Danger, dude. That TV show, was that before you started doing all the stunts? Because like that's kind of like a combination of like all it. Like, because you were doing a lot of crazy. You were doing like a lot of more different stuff. Anyone out there? Mike had a show called Strangers in Dangers, or right, Strangers in Danger. That's what it's called, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
On Fuel Fuel TV, and they did a lot of cool stuff. That's kind of like you're doing BMX stuff and stunts, but you're doing all kinds of other like different eating weird shit too, right?
Yeah, well, that happened later on, and all that stuff, and all the ESPN stuff and some stuff, I started doing some TV hosting here and there just because people knew I could talk before the camera, and so I would fill in for people here and there, and then we actually got this Strangers in Danger TV show, me and this guy, Zach, and we would go, the show was we would go all over the world, we'd go to these countries, and we'd do things specific to the country, whether it was eat their food, do their jobs, train with some of their military or do their customs or rituals, and they're all things people sort of push it a lot to Jackass, but it's really, I don't think anything like Jackass. But Jackass is all things that don't exist, you know, like rocket kayaking and suburban hockey or whatever, or you know, this was all things that people actually do, but us trying to do it, and some of it was really, really gnarly. Like, I don't know how we got to do it. I mean, I did one in Lebanon, which was the Lebanon Special Forces. And we did one where literally they shot bullets at me from 40 paces and shot balloons all around me and then a balloon out of my mouth.
Dude, you going to trust these fools with that?
Do I what?
You trusted these fools with that? With your life like that?
I mean, to be honest, I was in sort of a dark place in my life. And at the time, I really didn't want to do the show. So I thought, man, if he shoots me, I get to go home. Let's do this.
Yeah, you got a good point there. You know, would they still pay you? Like, hey, I got shot. Workman's comp, bro. See, you're always thinking. Work the angles. This is why you've never worked a regular job. I get it now. I get it.
Dude, the crazy thing is, in that first season, we got paid so little that we had to be gone 64 days straight. We had one day off. We had one or maybe 2 days off of travel. Every day we did something, even on travel days. So we had 1-2 days off. And it was like every day was like eating terrible things, getting beat up. It was gnarly, right? At one point, we were entered in a Muay Thai fight in Thailand, and like we were getting bet. People could bet on us when we just got beat up with professional fighters. But we had made such little money on that first season that after I had paid my rent at home that I had to pay while I was gone, I think I was gone 64 days. Did all these things, went to 20, or I would have gone to like 13 countries, and I think at the time it was 260 different bits of like whatever little bits we were doing, and I think I came home with $4,400.
After bad.
I paid all my bills.
What do you mean? That's a good deal, dude. What are you talking about, bro?
I basically made 1,500, like I basically made like 2,500 bucks a week.
That's back though when 4,400 was like 10 grand a day, bro.
Yeah, right.
I know.
Really think you get rich on that stuff, but those little networks and those shows, you don't.
Is there going to be another season ever of Strangers in Danger?
There was 2 seasons, 20 episodes. There's been talk. There's another network that we shot pilots for that wanted something similar to that. If there was ever another episode, I don't know, and there's no time that I would know would happen. I don't even know if I would do it. It would have to be something. That conversation and deal would have to be put in front of me, because doing what we did is, it's taxing on the body. It's taxing mentally. We do really dangerous stuff, and we also eat and do a lot of horrible things. And because of the way the show's designed, it requires a long time on the road, and it's a really hard show to do.
Well, you were good for it, though, dude. I was proud of you when you were doing that show. I was like, oh, man, because you from writing and then to this and then back into, going to TV. And you know what I mean? I was like, oh, okay, yeah, man, he's diversifying himself. I dig this, you know?
I appreciate it. I mean, we did 28 episodes of that, and then after that, I did a show called World Adventure Sports. I did another, like, maybe 20-some episodes of that. And before Stranger in Danger, I was actually on LA for 2 seasons. I don't really know how that happened. But
oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot about that show.
Yeah, I forget about that.
No way. Yeah, that's right.
I forget about that.
So you've done a lot of shows, dude. Yeah.
Yeah. I've done about 70 or 80 episodes of television.
Wait a second. So you didn't like the LA Inc. show? You didn't like that show?
No, it was cool. No, it was good. I just, I thinking back, it's the one that I look at that just it's just that it doesn't. It, other ones I get, and I'm like, oh, that makes sense. That makes sense. But when I even because I forget that I was even on it, and then it's just like, why are you part of a catchy show? So it was, no, it was great. It was a really great experience. Everyone I worked with was amazing. I'm very thankful for that opportunity. Nothing bad to say about it at all. It's just the one show that seems out of place when I if you wrote them all down, you're like, why were you on this show?
Yeah, well, it's because you have a good personality, bro. That's why. I mean, you know, and people
that's
like to
they,
be.
That's what they say about ugly girls. So thank you.
No, not necessarily. Crazy ass. No, but yeah, I get it. I get it. You kind of probably felt out of place because everyone's tattooing, and you're like, and at the time you probably had like 2 tattoos, and you're like, oh, what am I doing on this show?
I got 20 some, I think. I don't.
Not then. You didn't have 20 tattoos then. You're lying.
Yeah.
Where are they at? By the way, I don't always get to see them.
They're all up and down the sides of my body.
Ooh,
getting
sexy.
I have some to show on my wrist, and I wish I didn't have those. Because I doing stunts, I got to cover them all up. If I could go back and take everyone off that you could see when you have regular clothes on, I would take all of them off.
All the tattoos?
Anyone that were above, below my short line and below, and anything that would be seen when I have regular clothes on, like shorts and a t-shirt.
Yeah, it's hard for Hollywood, huh? Because the tattoos are very, like...
It requires extra time to cover that shit up.
Yeah, without a doubt. When did you get into skydiving, dude? Because this is something I've never done, and I'm still terrified to do it. Every time I see you posting skydiving, I'm like, "She's bananas, bro. I ain't doing that shit."
I wanted to do it back. There was a time when I was going to do it back in the 90s, and I was on my way to do it. We were doing school shows, and I flipped a van with a huge trailer full of ramp off the road, down a cliff, end over end, destroyed everything, and that I was on my way to go. We were doing shows. It was winter in Colorado. I flipped it all down there, and that sort of took all my money, my skydiving money, so I had to go home. And then it took another, like, probably 2007, where I went to go do it again. I started the first level, and then I did 2 levels, and then I was scuba diving in Villa Cortez down in Mexico, and I got barotrauma, and I screwed my sinuses up, so then I had to wait another few years. My ears were better. Scott happened. So it was probably 2008 or so that I started, and I fell in love with it. I really like it. I go through phases where I do it more than other times, and I base jump for a little bit, and I don't do that anymore. And then I flew wingsuits for a while, and I kind of took a break on that. But it really is one of those things that is really, really a wonderful, wonderful sport.
It's amazing, dude. I still am scared to go. I got to go with you sometime. I mean, every time I see you post stuff, I'm like, and I mean, you're not afraid to do it much. Are you? What have you ever been afraid to do anything? Because you bungee jump, you skydive, you this, that, you snowboard, you flip helicopters. You do. Come on, Mike.
I mean, on the show, on the Stranger in Danger, it puts you in a different mindset because it was like, all right, today you're going to learn how to bullfight. And then they're going to tell you something for 20 minutes, and all of a sudden you're standing in a ring holding a sheep, and there's a bull 10 feet away from you staring at you. It all comes down to, when it comes to being scared to do something, it comes down for me about knowledge, right? The more knowledge you have about something, the less scarier it is, because then you can decide whether or not you want to do it. If you don't want to do it, it's no longer scary because it's not an option in your life. But if you're going to do something, the more you know about it, you learn how to deal with things. You learn, like skydiving seems scary, but once you learn how a parachute works, then and how it's packed and how it deploys and how it wants to open and it wants to fly, then you have a reserve and how it opens, it takes away sort of, you know what I mean, some of these nervous thoughts. And so for me, anything that I want to do, I just try to get a little more knowledge about it, because what I don't want to do is, like, I hate the term thrill seeker or daredevil, right? Because I don't hate people who call themselves daredevils. To me, when people think those words, they think that people are just like, screw it, I'm going for it. And they're unskilled and just nuts. And I don't see those things that way at all. So when I see one of my friends do something, and I know he's prepared for it, and I know he's worked on it, there's times I definitely get scared because things can go wrong and it's dangerous. But I also have a different version of scared than I think a regular person who doesn't involve themselves with those sort of activities. So So for me, I don't. You know what's scary to me is going down an alleyway in gang territory. That seems scary.
Yeah, that's pretty shady. That, really. Yeah, that would be shady.
And my daughter getting hurt, like a serious accident or something. That scares me when I think about that. Also, you know what scares me? Here's what scares me.
What?
It's some sort of massive disaster, either it be natural disaster or terrorist attack, where everyone around you turns on themselves, and you've got and all of a sudden you're at war with every house in your neighborhood.
Hey, that's a good movie script. You should start writing that, dude. Hey, my new that would be scary, but you know you're a pretty brave dude, man. You could pull through. You would come through that, dude. You base jump down or something, or you'd parachute in like you'd pull it off somehow, bro.
I mean, those are the things that scare me. That's the things like that. But we did. You know, I was part of something that would help with that. I mean, that was one of the I was actually part of I'm part of a company called Uncharted Supply Co. I'm a co-founder in that, where we make emergency survival bags and go bags, and that was one of the things, one of the reasons why I was so interested in being part of it, because I felt like that was something that would if everyone had one of these in their house, it would instantly give you a little buffer of time before everyone started going nuts. And actually, with that company, we actually went on Shark Tank too.
Yeah, no, I was going to talk to you about your company. I think that, how did you link up? How did you guys all come together with this idea, first off? And explain a little bit more about what the product is.
So, the product is the company's called Uncharted Supply Co.
Right.
The product that we started out with was called the 72. It's in stores now, they're like an emergency bag, but all those emergency bags are really garbage, right? They're really, it's either like a blow dart gun and a slingshot, or it's like SEAL Team 6. It's either stuff you don't need or stuff, like you don't need night vision goggles, right? So we made a bag that was really smart, had all the directions and everything you needed in an emergency situation, all printed on all the pockets and everything went on, and it's something that should last you and keep you alive for 72 hours. Most survival situations, 95% of all survival situations, end in 72 hours. So that was what we were focusing on. And it actually, it did great. We did a crowd. We started it with a crowdfunding campaign that killed it. I think we made $500,000 in like 45 days or something. And then we got asked to come on Shark Tank, and we got a deal on Shark Tank, which we ultimately later didn't take months after. So it takes a while for that to happen. And company's doing great. We have a bunch of new products, always evolving. And I don't have as much to do with it as I did before in the early stages. But those guys are working really hard, and they're coming up with some really, really cool things.
Man, and that's right up your alley with all the things that you do. You travel the world constantly. You're always doing crazy shit. You're always doing rad stuff. That's like perfect. You know, I need to get me one of these. You know, it keeps you alive for 72 hours. It's like a water in it or something, and like some Band-Aids or something. What's in it? What's exactly in the thing?
So it's got it's basically based on things like basically air, food, and shelter, right? So there is a hierarchy of what you need, right? Because you can go, what is it, whatever, you know, 3 days without water or whatever, you know, I don't know all the facts anymore. But and a certain amount of days without food, but really, you can't go that long with is without a shelter. So this bag has a shelter pocket where you have like things that'll keep you warm, things that'll start fires. It has all the directions on how to do it. It's a pocket that has food, how to ration it. Has a place where you can filter and just filter water. It has a pocket for medical. It has a pocket that has shovels and things like that. The whole bag itself turns into a flotation device. It has sleeves in it. They can turn into snowshoes or arm slings. It's a really, really smart bag, and it's evolved so much since we started. So it really, really is something that I think everybody should have, not just because I'm a part of the company, but it's one that everyone should have in a trunk of their car, because it's not one of these. It's not a survival system that you're like, I'm waiting for the zombie apocalypse. That's it.
Well, that's what
it's
I was going to ask you.
Like, oh,
yeah, could you live? So it wouldn't work for the zombie apocalypse. That's what I'm worried about.
It would work, you know, for a little bit. But it's more like let's say you're on the 405 or the freeway here, and there's a 20 car pileup. you know, and you get hurt and it's going to take a while for a 50-car pileup or something, it's going to take a while for people to get you, you can address some of the situations for the people in your car and maybe some people in the surrounding cars to give them enough time to get the help they need.
Yeah, I could see that. You know, I could see, like, if someone's got their arm cut off, it's kind of more punk rock, though, if, like, you take off your belt and you tie it, like, you know, get punk with, take off your shirt, rip it up, like, ah, stay alive, Tony, ah. Does that sound, like, sound cool?
Yeah. while I'm sitting next to LIGAR fixing someone's broken arm, I'm just picturing you with a belt, like, with a belt wrapped around your neck, you're on fire, and you're trying to put it out.
Yeah, I could do that. No, someone's, I mean, look, where could someone get a bag, dude? Is there an Instagram or a website?
Just on servicesupplygo.com, and you look for the 72 is the bag. That's it. But there's a lot of stuff. We got a couple different bags, a couple different clothes, some jackets, some other just regular stuff. And we have some new, they have some new products coming out that are really, really cool that I can't really talk about. One, because I don't really know all the things they're doing because they have so much stuff going on.
I got you. But all their products are geared towards survival.
Yeah, the company in general is based on survival and basically helping your family be safe.
That's pretty rad. Everybody, check it out. Get a survival bag. I wanted to ask you one last thing. You got your own podcast coming out, right? You want to talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, I am. I think for years I wanted to do a podcast, and I always was just like, no one needs another podcast, and I felt like I missed the boat. And then I just sort of lately, I just like, you know what, I'm gonna give this a go. I talked to somebody that just felt like right. So I've been working on a podcast. It's not out yet. We're shooting to be out in July, I'm hoping. It's called Keep Bleeding, and we're gonna talk to people who have a job or a passion that requires them to continue to give blood, whether it be actual physical blood or it means they've had to evolve and adjust and change their mindset to continue to do that passion. So that's sort of the jump-off place. And it's been great. We've had some really great guests, and I'm really excited about it. I can't wait for people to hear it.
Man, I hear you, Roof. You've always gone for it. You've always expanded and been super diversified and just going for it, and I admire it. You've toured the world. You've done a lot of cool stuff. You've been a super rad dude. We've been friends for like 20-something years. Let's do another 50, bro. You've inspired me, actually, in a lot of different ways. I never told you because I figured it would go to your head.
Is it because of my hair? Is it my hair?
No, I figured it would go to your head. Like, you'd be like, that's right. That's right, bitch. That's what's up. But, like, no, you've inspired me.
That is right, bitch.
No, like, from videoing to, like, shooting photos to like ideas to like, you've inspired me in a lot of ways to like go out with my GoPro and shoot my own photos and do my own thing. So you inspire a lot of people, dude. You know, despite what everyone you think says about you that you suck balls, you don't. You don't suck balls, Mike.
Wait, what?
Huh?
Who says that?
What? Oh, you've been out of the industry for a while, bro.
Oh man!
I'm just joking, Mike. Just
because
we're recording
really about this, I felt really good about this. The feeling like, oh wow, all right, well, maybe it was.
No, you don't. Come on, it's just a joke, dude. You pick on me for how many years, bro? One time I fall asleep in Malaysia on the back of the tour bus, and I woke up and everyone's laughing. I'm like, what? Later on, I found a photo where you had put your ass cheeks on the side of my cheek while I was sleeping, looking over, laughing, thumbs up. Thanks, buddy. Yeah, huh? Uh-huh.
That is not a real story, is it?
It is a real story. And you were like a little, I was like, why is everybody laughing? I was just sleeping, man. But like 2 seconds before that, your bare ass was on my face, dude. Disgusting.
Dude, I don't even remember that. It doesn't even ring a bell.
Oh, it does to me every time I see you, Tony. Okay, huh?
Yeah, and please look for that photo. I would love that.
Man, I was so mad. I was like, oh, man, I was all, like, defensive and shit. Like, everybody's laughing at me. There's an ass cheek on my face, man.
The best thing about that is, like, back then, now it's like you get... Right now, you do something like that, and you have instant gratification. You got a photo. You can show people. Everyone can laugh at it. Back then, you had to really wait for the payoff for that joke. I had to get home from Malaysia. Had to wait a week to get my film developed. And then I would have had to mail you the photo.
Exactly. And make sure the photo wasn't blurry. You know what I mean? Like, you know.
That joke probably took 6 weeks to pay off. That's amazing.
Yeah, well, whatever, dude. It definitely, like, yeah, I was like pissed. I was like, dude. But yeah, I love you. I don't care. I would have done the same to you. You just beat me to it.
Yeah.
Well, cool, bro. Well, listen, man, thanks a lot for taking time. What's your Instagram so people can follow you?
It's just my name, at Mike Escamilla.
Awesome, dude. Awesome. Well, bro, thanks a lot for the interview. Let's go shred some pools soon. You know what I mean? Let's go.
Yeah, dude. Let's do it.
Okay, brother. Have a great day.
Thanks for having me on, Rick. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Keep inspiring, brother. All right. Take care.
See you. Bye.